Welcome to 30 Minutes in the New Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, joined by Eric Sorensen. Eric, how's it going, man?
It's going well. It's going, I've been running around all day today doing lots of work for my kids. I got a little guy who's sick in the home, and so that means, in New York City, what that means is 3 hours at a doctor's office, which also means 3 hours not doing all sorts of things that I need to get done. But such is the life of a father of three boys. So other than that, though, you know, my boy's not that sick. So things are going well. Things are good, man.
All right. That's good. That's good. Well, I'm good, too, Eric. Thanks for asking. What we got going on today?
I just always assume you're good, Dan, because you're always in such a chipper mood.
Always. Dude, except my neighbor, I think, has just begun mowing the yard. Come on, man. Don't you know I'm trying? Come on.
Schedule. He's not aware that you're trying to record a podcast?
I'm going to have to post my schedule on this guy's door.
We're in Matthew 9. We ended at verse 8 last time, and today we pick it up at verse 9. Reads like this: as Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. I love that. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners."
Oh, man, that's so good.
Well, if there was ever a passage that you could drive a dump truck through with the gospel, this might be it. So, but before we get ahead of ourselves, let's for the sake of context and everything, Matthew is a tax collector. What do we know about tax collectors at that time, Dan?
Well, what you got is you got a Jewish people under Roman occupation, and what the Romans would do was they would they'd find some Jewish people to collect taxes for them. They knew the people. They knew what was up, and so they would have them collect some taxes. And they didn't mind so much if these particular Jews took a little off the top, maybe charge a little extra for the taxes, and then they pocketed. So the tax collectors ended up being fairly well off. Through basically extortion, and that's how it went. Now that's why the tax collectors were loathed. They weren't loathed because they were Romans. They were loathed because they were Jews, and they were seen as traitors.
Right, they were Jews that were ripping off Jews on behalf of the empire.
It's like the worst
occupying force.
It's the worst, man. So I mean, in a lot of ways, tax collectors. I mean, you see it in the Gospels. Like that's like a slur, man. Like tax collectors in a lot of ways are like the worst of the worst. I mean, in the Jewish mind, there's nothing worse than a tax. Like, hey, prostitution's bad, but tax collecting, that's real bad.
Right. I mean, you see the words tax collectors, prostitutes, sinners lumped together in a synonymous way, because that is just the way people thought about these guys that were doing this work. And there is numerous examples of tax collectors in the Gospels, and none of them have a lot of buddies. None of them are very popular with the people.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an accident that it's like tax collectors and sinners, as if it's like a whole other category.
Right, right. It's just, I mean, they're lumped together. They're the worst of the worst. And, I mean, listen, man, understandably so. I mean, these guys were, you know, they were traitors. They were traitors to their people. They were, because it wasn't just that they were doing what Rome told them to do. Like, if they were just doing the job of collecting taxes for the Roman government, listen, no one likes having taxes taken out of their livelihood, but you accept it. You know, but the problem was, is everyone knew it was common knowledge that these guys were taking a cut for themselves. And so they're ripping their fellow countrymen off while doing the bidding of Rome. So they were really seen as just a mess of people.
Yeah, and like you don't need to have a bunch of sympathy on a tax collector as far as they're not wrong when they're like, these guys are not cool, man. Like, they weren't cool. Like, I mean, Jesus is not, like, you know, affirming extortion when he calls, like, and hangs out with tax collectors in any way. Like, I mean, these guys are terrible. Like, and Jesus knows it. But, dude, turns out...
That doesn't stop Jesus.
Turns out that's what he's here for.
That's right. I mean, I love how quickly this whole thing happens. Sees Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he says to him, "Follow me." Two words. And Matthew rose and followed him.
It's monergism.
Dude, no joke. I mean, you talk about that word having power. There it is. The word has power. Follow me. Done.
Yeah, folds it up, bails. Which, you know, I mean, and it's too, like, you know, Jesus, like, is calling his disciples. So he calls some fishermen over here, and he calls, like, their brothers over there, calls a dude under a fig tree, you know, doing his thing. And it's like, he sees a tax collector, and, like, and he's like, perfect. This is exactly what I need to round out my posse.
Right. Well, you consider, especially that, you know, Jesus also has, as part of his 12 disciples, a zealot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what a zealot was, you could not get a more polar opposite person to a tax collector than a zealot, because a zealot was, they existed to be anti-Rome. They were working to fight the oppressive regime.
They're like political anarchists.
Right. I mean, they're fighting against the regime. Matthew's working for the regime. And Jesus says, "Hey, how about both of you follow me?" Which, let me just say, especially in a place like New York City where I'm ministering, where I'm planting a church, that attitude of being able to allow the extremes of both political points of view or different points of view has to be habituated in the church. And it most certainly goes beyond New York City. I think you see more of those extremes in big cities oftentimes. But if you can't welcome both the guy who's the zealot, anti-government guy, and the guy who's super pro-government guy, or woman for that matter, both into your congregation, then there's something wrong. Because that's exactly what Jesus does. Jesus goes after everybody. He doesn't look to go see what their voter registration ID is before he determines whether they're worthy of following him. No one's worthy of following him. It doesn't matter what their political point of view is. Everybody starts off unworthy, and what makes them worthy is the call of Christ to say, "Mine, you follow me."
What do you think it says, what it means when it says that Jesus reclined at table in the house? Is this Peter's house, or did he go to Matthew's digs?
It's not certain, so we can't be dogmatic about it, but it would seem to me that he's talking about Matthew's house.
Right, because all these other tax collectors are showing up.
Especially because many tax collectors were there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it seems like if there was going to be a place where other tax collectors would sort of naturally gather, it would be at their buddy tax collector's home.
Yeah. Well, all I know is this doesn't go over well.
Well, here's the thing about this. I mean, we are not led to believe that the other tax collectors and sinners that were reclining with Jesus and his disciples were followers of Jesus yet.
No, they're just hanging out.
This is really important because, sometimes there's this sense in which, Christians should only hang out with Christians. And if we do hang out with non-Christians, it's only for the purpose of proselytizing. But beyond that, we shouldn't really have too much relationship with them. But this verse flies in the face of that. Jesus is reclining, having really intimate table fellowship in some degree with people that appear to not be his converts yet.
Right. Yeah. And you hear, like, when the Pharisees heard about this, you know, they see it, and they're going to the disciples trying to, like, break this thing up and roll off with the question. Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and other kinds of sinners? But Jesus, of course, hears this and rolls out something awesome.
Yeah, one of my favorite little passages. But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." And the scandal.
Dude, I had a guy tell me, straight up, he's like, "You talk like your sin is what qualifies you for the gospel." I don't know about qualifies, but like, if you ain't a sinner, like, you don't need no God. Like, Jesus ain't for you. It's scandalous, I know.
Any truer statement than that statement. If you are not a sinner, then Jesus has nothing for you. This passage proves that. His whole life proves that.
So, yeah, well, I would say, like, nothing qualifies you for grace, but there is things that make the grace necessary, which would be your sin.
Correct. Now, this is in no way, again, as we stated earlier, Jesus isn't endorsing Matthew's extorting of the people. He's not endorsing sin. He's just acknowledging a reality that sinners are the ones that need saving.
Right.
And that's what he's in the business of doing.
It's more like this. I mean, like, listen, I'm not telling you that you should go out and sin. I'm telling you that you go out and sin, which is not the same thing. Like, I'm not saying, hey, you got, you know, hey, sin is what you should go do. I'm just saying sin is what you go do.
Right. I'm just calling you what you are. You are a sinner.
Yep.
This is something that the Pharisees really didn't want to have a category for. I mean, they really hated this throughout his life, and this is one of the things that got him in so much trouble, is that he was hanging out with these kinds of people, the people that weren't clean, weren't particularly observant in their faith, or not observant at all. And Jesus gives the reason that they're the ones who need a physician because they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so he quotes from Hosea, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice." Mm-hmm. And I love that. I mean, because it's possible, as we saw with the Pharisees, to do all the right religious observances. It's possible to do the liturgy perfectly every Sunday morning, with all the right prayers, with all of the readings. It's possible to sacrifice the exact right animal on the altar and yet still not get the gospel.
Yeah, because you can do that and be the most unmerciful person in the world.
Absolutely. And sadly, sometimes that is the case.
Yeah.
It's often the most religious people that are the most unmerciful.
Yeah.
Because they're banking their righteousness on, whether they say it or not, whether they acknowledge it or not, functionally, they bank their righteousness on their performance of these things. And so everybody that is not performing is by default not righteous and therefore not worthy to have a place in the kingdom. And Jesus says the exact opposite is true. Like, what you should have been doing, instead of focusing on this sacrifice so much, you should have been merciful.
Right. And this isn't to say that, well, if you're merciful, then God will accept you. But what it does say is that if you are someone who understands their position rightly, you will know that you are a recipient of mercy, and that will make you into a merciful person. So the person who is unmerciful typically has not wrapped his head around the amount of mercy that he has received from God.
Right. We see parables emphasizing that numerous times throughout the Gospels, where Jesus basically says the reason that somebody isn't forgiving, or the reason that somebody is stern and not able to come alongside somebody who is a sinner, is ultimately because they don't see how much they need forgiveness from as well.
Right. And this is why Jesus says that, well, one, like, mercy is in the heart of God. Like, that's how he rolls. He is merciful. It's descriptive, mm-hmm, of him. And that's why he's able to say that I came to call the right, I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. And this is there's a lot in that statement, because that means that he came to call people while they were sinners.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, still in,
Romans 5
still,
backs that up.
It's still in the sin. Not when they got it straightened out, not when they fixed it, not when they, you know, cleaned it up. No. Like, while you were a sinner, that's who I've come to call people in their sin to come and follow me.
That's going to be messy.
A little bit.
And it's good, but that's the glorious way the kingdom of God operates. Like, you know, the thing is, when somebody is converted, I mean, those of us who are pastors and have been doing this for a little while, we know that when a person is a new convert, that they're not automatically going to start sounding all righteous.
Right.
or acting righteous. There's going to be a lot of struggle, and there's going to be a lot of things that they're still doing that aren't right, that aren't good. And frankly, I mean, oftentimes in the Christian church, that can go on for many, many years, but we just train ourselves to kind of hide it. And the invitation of Jesus, the call of Jesus, is actually like, no, come to me and be real with me about that.
Right.
I mean, he comes to Matthew in the midst of the act of tax collecting. He's sitting at his booth collecting dough.
Yeah.
And Jesus says, right now, come with me.
Yeah, that's how he rolls. Calls people in their sin, man. In their sin.
And he doesn't let him stay there. This is the glorious thing. Like over time, you know, he works in their life through the power of the Holy Spirit. And you do begin to see that some of the things that you used to do, you might not be prone to doing anymore. You find that you're struggling. You might be struggling with new things or different things. But there is a struggle there now. And whereas there may not have been before.
Yeah.
And really, what Jesus is doing with his disciples, as you look at them all, you know, after 3 years of ministry with him, they don't look very impressive by the end of that 3 years.
No, at the end of like 3 years of seminary with Jesus, like, Judas is betraying him and Peter is denying him and the rest of them are running.
That's right. I mean, it doesn't look, they don't look like they've grown in their sanctification nearly as much as we might hope.
Yeah, Thomas, even after Jesus is crucified, and then, like, they're like, hey, he rose from the dead. Thomas is like, yeah, right.
Right. Even though Jesus had been saying multiple times, hey, guys, guess what? I'm going to die, and then I'm going to rise again, okay? It's going to happen this way. And they're like, so what are you trying to say?
The cross was a little much for them.
Right. And understandably so. But the point of all this is to say that, you know, you might have been a Christian for a long time, or you might be a brand new Christian. And, you know, don't give up. Don't think that, you know, you must not be the real deal if you find yourself still struggling with sin. Guess what? You're just like the Apostle Paul. You're just like the Apostle Peter. You're just like all of these guys, all of the heroes of the faith.
I'd take it even a step further than that and say, if you roll up in here and say, yeah, actually, I don't really have anything I can think of that I'm struggling with, I would be like totally freaked out and be like, that's horrifying.
Yeah, that's a worse sign.
Absolutely. That's it. That is not a good sign.
Yeah. It's maturity in the Christian life is downward. It's not upward.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, let's move on from that. So then the disciples of John came to him saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? And Jesus said to them, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. No one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch tears away from the garment, and a worse tear is made. Neither is new wine put into old wineskins. If it is, the skins burst, and the wine is spilled, and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins, and so both are preserved. What's that all about, Dan?
It's a little tricky.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, like, we'll try to do this fast. We got like about 10 minutes here. Well, one, so these are the disciples of John the Baptizer. They're rolling up in there. And here's the thing. So at the very least, the Pharisees would fast every Wednesday. Bare minimum. Mm-hmm. But Jesus' disciples aren't doing this. And the disciples of John are doing this. Mm-hmm. Because they don't fully get it yet. They don't fully get it. And so they join in this fasting, and the Pharisees do the fasting. There's nothing really wrong with the fasting. But here's the thing. Like, when Jesus says, here's the reason we don't do it, he says, is that the bridegroom is with them. In other words, look, bro, in the kingdom of God, in the new heavens and the new earth, ain't gonna be no fasting. Be lots of feasting, but we ain't gonna be fasting for anything.
Yeah, no need.
And, like, because God is there with them, there is no need for them to fast. So you see Jesus fast in the wilderness and during the temptation, but there's no disciple fasting going on. And that's because Jesus is with them. It's heaven has come to earth. Mm-hmm. And then he uses this weird example where he talks about no one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment and this kind of thing. And what he's doing here is that the Pharisees thought that this fasting was most certainly earning them something with God. They thought this was straight-up law-keeping. This wasn't mm-hmm. fasting because you've determined, you know what, I'm going to fast because I'm going to deny myself some things, and I want to pray, but nothing like that. This was all about, first of all, external righteousness and people seeing it, and then also, like, you know, God's going to be really pleased with me if I do this fasting. I'm going to regiment right. this out.
Jesus covers that in the Sermon on the Mount because of that reality.
Exactly. We've been there. So this mm-hmm. fasting is law, mm-hmm. and they have Jesus in the flesh. Okay, and so when he talks about no one takes an unshrunken piece of cloth and to pass a garment, what he's saying is, like, so if you have a garment and you take it has a hole in it and you sew it with you put a patch on it that's an unshrunk piece of cloth, then you wash it and then you dry it, that patch that's unshrunk will shrink and rip away, and he says the hole is made worse. Likewise, you don't put new wine into old wineskins, if it is the skins will burst and the wine will spill out of it because you have this stuff ferments and there's gases and all this kind of stuff, right? So the way what he's saying here is that you don't get to have Jesus, you don't get to have the gospel and the law as your means of salvation. You don't get to say, like, check it out, I got this garment. It's a law garment. It's got some fasting. It's got some spiritual disciplines. It's my law garment. It's got a couple holes in it because I haven't done it perfectly. What I would like to do is just sew up, if I could just do a little, some gospel patchwork, just sew a little Jesus on to cover up these holes, I think I'll be all right. No, you can't have that. No, that will not happen, because what will happen is that will rip away and you will lose both. Mm-hmm. And then it's the same thing with the wineskins, where you're like, you know what, you know, I think this is pretty good. If I just, you know, pour a little Jesus in me the way I am, you pour a little Jesus into my law keeping, pour some Jesus in my law keeping, and you know what, I think I'm going to be all right. He's like, no, man, I think you just blow up. It's not going to work. And so this is about, he's like, I'm here. I'm keeping the law. I'm the embodiment of, I am righteousness manifested, as Paul says in Romans 3. There's no need for anything else. Mm-hmm. I'm the whole thing, man. Like, I gotta be your garment. I gotta mm-hmm. be the thing that you're poured into. Mm-hmm. You can't have me and your law keeping and, like, somehow, like, try to blend these together. This is straight up Galatians stuff.
Right. This is what the Judaizers were doing. This is, I mean, the Judaizers would say, yes, Jesus, that's fine. Yes, Jesus is the Messiah. They would accept that. They'd say, okay, yeah, Jesus fulfilled the prophecies about the Messiah. We believe that. Now, you just got to make sure that you do all the same things that Jewish people have done for the last couple thousand years. Follow the law, follow kosher, follow all that stuff, and then add Jesus to it. And essentially what Jesus is saying here is, no, there's no, I don't get added on to anything. Like, right. In other words, you have to die and be risen again.
Right. So what Jesus is talking about here is like the reverse, but the same thing is going on with the Judaizers. So here they're like, hey, can we add a little bit of the new hot rabbi's teaching to our law keeping? God probably like that, right? And he's like, no, I'm not going to be a patch for you. The flip side, what the Judaizers were doing, be like, no, man, you got to have that Jesus. Also, man, here's a couple of law patches that you could sew on there. Also, no. Wrong. Yeah. It's all Jesus, man. Jesus is everything. It's the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and John's disciples, they do struggle with this. They don't get this. You know, it's not, this is not the last time that John's disciples will come to Jesus and be like, are you really the one? Because, like, you know, we're hearing things and we're seeing things that, they're making us a little nervous. Yeah. Are you sure you're the one? And so Jesus, this isn't the last time that Jesus has to tell them, listen, yes, I'm the one, trust me. Trust me. Watch what I do.
And I mean, we see this exact thing played out in preaching all over the world, where people will do this and the reverse of this. They will either say, "You got some holes in your life? Jesus can patch those right up. You feeling empty? Uh-huh. You pour in some Jesus, fill that right up." Wrong. That's not what he does. That's not what he came to do. That's not what he's going to do. Or the reverse, they'll be like, you got Jesus? That's great. You got to have Jesus. You've given your life to him. That's fantastic. But you know what? You still got a couple of things. We're going to sew on a little law, help you out with those.
Yeah, it's not enough. It's not enough. Jesus enough. Jesus alone is not enough. I can remember, sitting in a church years ago. It was I was invited there by a friend. It was sort of almost like a weird culty church. I didn't know that at the time, but the preacher got up there and he told the story about a young man who had been converted, and the young man came to him discouraged after a few weeks. And he said, you know, Pastor, I'm still struggling with sin. I can't seem to beat these things. It's just a few weeks after he became a Christian. And, you know, from my experience, I'm waiting for the pastor to give a word of assurance to this kid. And the pastor says, and so I told him, that must mean that your conversion wasn't genuine. And so we did it again. We prayed again. We asked for the Lord to come into his life and to give him the ability to now truly walk in faith.
Prayed to Moses.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, so that poor kid, one of two things happened, right? Either one, the kid felt that he couldn't come to his pastor again if he struggled with sin, so he pretended, right? He pretended from then on, like, oh, everything's great. But God knows the secrets of his heart and knows that everything's not great. Or the kid surely gave up in despair, because at some point you go, I can't pretend anymore. I can't live with the mask on anymore. And this is just me. I'm struggling with these things. I continue to struggle with these things. I must not really be a Christian. And that's what that kind of preaching does, when we try and just sort of add Jesus on or add law on to Jesus to make sure we're genuine enough in our faith. I mean, it'll kill us. It'll kill us one way or the other.
It'll also make you not want to go eat with tax collectors and sinners, unless you get like your robe of law righteousness dirty.
Yeah, you'll be polluted.
Can't do that.
No,
I can't be around that stuff. I'm trying to keep this robe pristine. And
I heard a guy say once that yes, Jesus can hang out with tax collectors and sinners, but we can't because we're not Jesus. And I thought that is probably the silliest way of understanding this passage I've ever heard in my life. Like, this is, of course, Jesus's followers are to do this. The Apostle Paul talks about this. He talks about engaging with non-Christians and having good conversation with them. He doesn't say to avoid the world. Not at all.
Dude, when people be like, you're if you hang out with those people, you're going to ruin your witness. I'm like, well, my pristine witness will not be useful if I can't hang out with them to witness to. I got like a squeaky clean witness, with, but I can't be around anyone that I need to witness to. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And don't worry about like dirtying up your witness by who you're hanging out with. Jesus wasn't worried about his he did not care about his reputation. He didn't believe in the transfer of sins. Like, oh no, I'm around this person and they're a sinner. That means I'm guilty by association. Like, he didn't worry about that stuff.
No, as a matter of fact, he was there to be made guilty by his association.
He was, that
was all the plan.
And he was going to do a lot more than just be guilty by association. He was going to be guilty by assumption of all sin.
That's right. That's right. I mean, he was going to take that was his purpose. And so Jesus wasn't running away from sinners. He was running after sinners. I mean, our God is the God who runs after the prodigal son. You know, our God is the God who doesn't allow the sheep to just run off and get lost. Well, you know, I guess he wasn't really part of the fold. No, our God's the one who goes after that lost sheep, leaves the 99, and goes and rejoices with a party when he finds that lost sheep to bring him home.
Yep, and he's not a God who patches up your law, your missteps and your law breaking. He's a God who strips that robe of filth off you and clothes you in himself. And that's the point of the passage, and that's the end of the podcast. We're done. That's it. Guys, we're going to be in Detroit next week. Next weekend, we're going to be in Detroit. And you can be there. It's going to be fun. If you're there, me and Eric are going to be there. If you're in the Michigan area, come on and hang out, man. Just come register at the door, whatever, man. Just show up.
If you're in the Michigan area, by the way, you just have to tell me. If you're there, you have to point me to where I can get the best Coney dog. That's what I've heard I need to get when I'm there. So help me out.
All right. There you got it. Eric needs to know. Hit him up on the Twitter. Hit him up on the Facebook. Coney dogs in Detroit area. We need to know. We'll go get them. We'll snap a pic of us eating them. It'll be great. Guys, thanks for hanging out. We will see you next week.